Spencer, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And Spencer, you are the founder and GP of Spencer Ventures, which is an institutional-grade NFT fund. So, Spencer, take me all the way back to, when you first discovered Web3. How did you discover it? What did you like about it? And how did it lead you to where you are today?
Yeah, so actually my journey starts like pretty early on in all of this stuff, in the sense of like my friends and I used to, when Dogecoin like kind of first came out, and Coinyecoin, if you remember that, we used to like it was kind of the gag gift in my friend group, was like if you forgot someone's birthday or you like didn't get them a present or whatever, you would just buy them like Coinyecoin or Dogecoin.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was one of those things which was like it wasn't a serious thing. And I think that's kind of the correct way to have approached, like, or have gotten into Web3. Now, I can't say I took this seriously for any meaningful amount of time. I had some coins in 2017, 16 cycle, but like wasn't a full-time focus. For me, it was actually NFTs was the thing that really dragged me full-time into this. So like I was an early investor in Bored Apes. I bought them for like $5,000 when they first kind of were out, from like being in Clubhouse and listening to a bunch of people in a room like make ape noises, which I think a lot of people forget is kind of the origin of a lot of this NFT run from last cycle. And I was like, this is so ridiculous. Similarly to the thesis of like Coinyecoin obviously didn't play out, and Doge, which did play out, is like, this is just silly. And like sometimes the silliest thing wins, right? And so for me also, like I had like prior to this been working in traditional venture, been a founder of a startup, but I also used to buy and sell Magic the Gathering trading cards. Like when I was originally running companies, I would bootstrap by like running trading card arbitrages, or like basically being a trading card vendor. And so like I saw NFTs and was like, oh, this is just like venture investing, but like with trading cards. Like this makes lots of sense. And so kind of the first thing that like really clicked for me was like, and I remember thinking like I'd rather drive a 2003 Toyota Camry and have a Bored Ape PFP than drive like a sports car and have no Bored Ape PFP, because the sports car is going to go down in price like every unit of time, but like this PFP is collectible, it can go up in price. And like, I have pieces of cardboard that are worth tens of thousands of dollars. Like it's not such a stretch for like a JPEG on the internet. Like I think this is one thing, like you actually see a lot of Magic the Gathering players in important positions in crypto. Like people don't forget the first crypto exchange was MTGOX, Mt. Gox, which is Magic the Gathering Online X, which was originally a Magic the Gathering online card trading platform, right? Like there's a lot of origins that overlap. Why? Because it's not a big leap. If you've already in your head gotten over paying tens of thousands of dollars for pieces of cardboard, paying tens of thousands of dollars for JPEGs on the internet for like magic internet money is like not that big a jump from there. It just makes sense, right? And so that was kind of my entry, was like, oh, this is actually like something that makes lots of sense. And I think like, one thing for me too is I was on this journey of like, okay, I was running a venture syndicate, right? Like the next step obviously was raise a venture fund. But you look at like the venture space and it's like, okay, there are people who have been investing since before the dot-com boom. Like one of the big challenges, I think, to breaking into venture, traditional venture capital is like there were a lot of angels in Uber, in Facebook, and all these things that now they like that's who you're competing against, like raising capital with. And it's like, oh man. Like I can't go back in time and make those investments. I can make investments now, but it's going to take 10 years for that to play out the way that that did. And so like you're walking into this industry with like all these legacy entrenched incumbents that like have these big platforms, they have their podcasts with tens of millions of followers. They were angel investors in like 17 unicorns that also, by the way, like that size unicorn like hasn't happened for a while. Like it's kind of, we don't have recent investments that become like Uber style things except for a couple, right? And so this very intimidating thing. And then you go to crypto, you go to NFT specifically, and it's like, okay, this industry is 1 year old, right? Like the opportunity, the ability to be someone meaningful in the scope of what this is so much greater than the ability was in sort of the Web 2 world. So that was one of the things that like really attracted me to it, is like, yeah, I could have done the other way, I could have done the traditional way, but like there's no way that I could have been that impactful in the first, 20, 30 years of the career. Whereas in Web3, it's like completely the opposite, right?
That's so cool. Yeah, no, that reminds me. I speak to a lot of investors of different types just because I'm curious. And oftentimes, and what they tell me is, oh, I was the first person to invest in this asset. And it's like some traditional asset I've never heard of. It's like mortgage rate default swap things, whatever. They were saying I knew that this was going to be a very large market, and I was very confident, very confident in my ability to generate returns there. And no one else was really focused on that. Or like there were other people, but it was like very small. And I knew it was going to be, this big. And getting in early into a new market is kind of the reoccurring theme I see between all these different investors. So that's a really cool thing you bring up about how, the early tech, you're competing against all these early tech folks who got into Uber and Facebook or whatever. And now we are the quote unquote early people that got into crypto and NFTs. And hopefully it's going to play out this, in a similar fashion, how we think. So take me back to Magic the Gathering. I think that's such an interesting point that you brought up because people with the collector mentality, kind of the trading mentality, there's so many similarities. I guess take me back to like how you first fell in love with Magic the Gathering. Are you a big player? Do you enjoy?
I like the game, but this was like a thing in middle school, high school for me was like, I like playing the game, but then also like, I kind of always was like a side hustly kind of guy. And like it, my first interaction with things that like went up in price substantially was Magic the Gathering cards. Like I had been playing a format called Commander. They released a new format called Modern, and that spiked a lot of the price of the random Commander cards that I bought. And so there were cards I bought for like a dollar that were suddenly worth $50, right? And this is a pre 12% inflation for 10 years kind of deal. Like that was a lot of money. And I got in middle school, right? And so I was making like 10 grand a year, like running trading card arbitrages in like middle school, and was like, wow, this is fun. This is cool. This is interesting. It was just the hustle that was most accessible to me, right, at that time, right? And it was in many ways permissionless. Like I used to make like eBay accounts with like, Amex gift cards, like, because you can't do that anymore. Like it used to be you could make, because like I didn't have a credit card, right? Like, so like this was like a whole like kind of thing that I was running, and like it was an accessible kind of hustle, but it also like made sense and was a market that basically just went up for a while. Like people don't realize this, but like Alpha Black Lotus, which is like the grail of Magic collections, is probably the best performing asset outside of Bitcoin that there is. Like it outperforms the S&P very consistently, and like doesn't have the volatility of crypto in that like it doesn't sell off 90% like every couple of years. And so there's this magical period of time, but like I think as it pertains to like the similarities, right? The market. So one thing that you see in crypto is a lot of people coming in from trad market. So you see a lot of people coming in where their background is, I was, quant and X hedge fund. I was like, I traded credit default swaps or whatever. I traded something in traditional markets that I am now bridging over. And I think a lot of people make a lot of mistakes because a lot of the strategies in traditional markets have a bunch of baseline assumptions in them that just aren't true in this market, right? And that's where having a different market experience is actually incredibly advantageous, right? Like people are used to a very efficient market. Also, tell you one thing, Italian black border dual lands have a completely different price for Magic in Europe than they do in America. Now, gold does not. Why? Because the gold is a much more efficient market, right? Like part of the nature of trading cards is its inefficiency. Part of the nature of NFTs, of crypto, is its inefficiency. Like there are cross-exchange arbs in crypto, right? There are, different prices, different ways, right? Like there is friction in finding buyer and seller, right? Like in Magic, if you are a dealer, you usually buy 30% under market. That's usually the buy price, right? So the bid-ask spread in Magic is 30%. Turns out in NFTs, it was something around that too, right? Now you also have to ship it. You have to insure it. Sometimes in Magic, if you're selling a card that's over $10,000, it's very common that people will get on a plane, fly somewhere, hand it to the person at the airport, get back on the plane and go back. Why? Because that is cheaper than the risk of loss from shipping. And so like, this is very similar actually to the marginal cost of the royalty enforced, like back in the royalty days of OpenSea, like that was a very similar amount of spread that you're taking on it, right? And so your understanding of risk, your understanding of what's going on, and your understanding of where you have to be a buyer in order to make a profit is different, right? And I think that was one of the things that like, to me, it was like, oh, I can outtrade these TradFi guys because they're used to all of these things in a market that don't exist here, because this is fundamentally more of a collectibles market than it is a financial market. Now, I will say over the last 2 to 3 years, like that has actually shifted substantially. Like it is much closer to a TradFi market. We're starting to see structured products. We're starting to see, perpetual swaps. So you can short to hedge risk, right? That is a huge structural change. One of the reasons that a lot of people fail, so a lot of people have blown up trying to market make NFTs. This is a very interesting phenomenon to witness. A lot of people have blown up. Now, why? Because of a couple of things. So first of all, market makers in a traditional sense are usually able to do something other than sell assets to hedge their risk when they're in inventory, right? So let's say you have a bid of 100 units and you're a traditional market maker, you're SIG, you're, you know, Susquehanna Investment Group, you're like Rentec, you're one of these guys, right? You're Citadel or something, right? You get filled 100 units. You have two options, or actually there's many options, but I'm going to talk about two options, right? You can buy puts against your long so that you're delta neutral on that position, or you can sell it, right? And usually you buy the puts and then you sell over time. Now, in NFTs, if you're market making and someone dumps 100 units into your bid, the only thing you can do is sell that 100 units. And guess what? There may not be another fool below you with a 100 unit bid on this collection. And so there's this huge amount of risk that you take in. Now, again, why is everyone market making? Because in TradFi, the people who print money are the market makers. And especially in TradFi, if there are not a lot of market makers, the one market maker prints money. So everyone from TradFi who comes into crypto wants to market make. Why? Because they are like, ooh, nation industry, there's probably not a lot of market makers. This is what we know makes money. But you know what doesn't work well in NFTs? Market making. Why? Because you don't have any ability to hedge spot. So you're just like exit liquidity, right? You're just exit liquidity as a service. And so, you know where else market making like doesn't work? Trading cards. Because like you have so many frictional costs to like ship things, and then like you can ban a card and it just becomes unusable. And you also don't have ability to short trading cards or buy put options, right? Now, that stuff, I think, will change over time. You see, like, in the coin market, market making works really well, right? Because you do have the ability to buy puts. You can short. You can. There are cross-marketplace ARBs. There is a robust order book. There's also Quorum of market makers where there is another fool with a 100-unit bid on every coin you're trading, right? Like, this is how this works in coin market is much closer to traditional market. Do I think NFTs will get there? Probably. That seems like the path that they're on. Are they there yet? Absolutely not, right?
Wow, okay. I love you. I love the exit liquidity as a service. That's hilarious. But okay, so that's a great kind of segue into like, what is Spencer Ventures? How did you decide to start Spencer Ventures?
Yeah, so I mean, Spencer Ventures was a couple of things. So I had this very good trading run in 2021, bought Bored Apes for like $5,000. I bought Artifact pre-qualify items, the shoes. I don't know if you remember this, but like if you had the Artifact shoe, which I bought for like half an ETH, you got airdropped three clones each.
Oh my gosh.
And so I sold almost everything in December of 21. And it's actually pretty funny. So so my personal Magic collection, right, I had actually sold out of in like 2016, 2017 entirely, because I was running a startup and I had to make payroll. And it was like, all right, I have cardboard that is worth a lot of money. I am running out of money that I have that is just money. And I have like people who I need to pay. And so it was one of those decisions of like, as emotionally attached as I am to my personal Magic collection, I'm going to sell it all to make payroll, because that's just what I have to do as a founder, right? And so in December of 2021, I was like, okay, we're up like 7,000% in 8 months on this portfolio. Like, you know, is it the top? I don't know, but it's certainly not the bottom. Like, this is seems like a good time to. And so it was funny, my partner was like, oh, like, so we're gonna have money. And I was like, even better, we're gonna have shiny trading cards. And so I rotated like almost all of my crypto into trading cards again. And it was funny, in like February and March of like that year, right, Black Lotus had like a 10% decline in price. And my trading card friends were like, oh my God, like, we lost so much money. And I'm sitting here with my like $100,000 of Magic cards that I bought that have gone down 10% in price, but I bought it with ETH at 40, like, you know, 4,200, and ETH is sitting at 1,000. Like, oh, shucks, so bad that this has gone down. So like, that was kind of my entry. And then what had happened was, you know, I knew a bunch of, so like from running a venture syndicate and like from being in the venture scene back then, like I knew a bunch of people and they were starting to reach out like, hey, you know, crypto is pulled back a lot. Like, we want to like invest, like, would you do like, I got some inbound from some family offices and friends of mine. They were like, would you do like a, you know, we like can't figure out how to get exposure that's right in this space. Like, can you structure a product for us? We'd like to do a venture fund. And I came back to them and I said, well, I had this kind of interesting experience where like, so funny thing about Artifact, like I had learned about them from talking to them about investing in their venture round. And at the end of that conversation, the founder said, hey, by the way, don't invest in the venture round, buy the NFT, right? And they sold to Nike like 6 months after that. And their acquisition was basically like a thing of 3 or 4x on the venture raise, and the NFT was a 200x. So I was like, okay, guys, I want to give you guys exposure, but let me structure something that's like kind of more interesting, right? Like, there's a lot of venture funds out there, but like, let's do something weirder, right? That I think is more kind of missing from the space. And so for me, Spencer Ventures is a liquid NFT fund. Now, what does that mean exactly? Is like, you know, and part of the reason I called it Spencer Ventures is kind of like whatever Spencer wants to do. Like, this is like an interesting, like ways to get exposure to things. And like having a pretty loose mandate allows us to stay on top of stuff. So we spot buy NFTs. We've run some like weird ARB strategies, but like, you know, we also provide liquidity for NFTFi infrastructure. We do all sorts of stuff, mostly on chain. So like, we were one of the top market makers on Blur in their first airdrop. I know I give this whole speech about how you shouldn't market make, but that was plus EV market making because your losses were offset by the points. And like, if you understood the calculations there, it was a really good return. You know, we're some of the biggest liquidity providers in the space. Now, it's grown substantially, like what we're doing and sort of our capital under management. But one of our really fortunate things was our timing. So like, when we raised the fund, we were like, so it was kind of interesting. We raised our first fund, like we had a pretty good first like month and a half. We'd invested like $600,000. It was up to like 1.2 million worth of value. Was feeling really good about it in like, you know, couple of weeks essentially. And I'm on a plane back from Europe, and I get on the plane and I'm hearing the, you know, oh, FTX balance sheet looking kind of dodgy, whatever. And I land and FTX is collapsing, and I'm like, oh my goodness. And so we went from being up $600,000 to, you know, we lost about $800,000 in like one day. Right. And I got on a call, and this is like, you know, imagine you've raised your first fund, you're doing well, and you lose almost $1 million in a day, right? Like, this is quite the starting a company experience, right? And so I get on a call with all my LPs, and I'm like, all right, guys, this is what happened. This is what's going on. But also, like, we happen to be mostly cash right now, and I think this is the best opportunity I've ever seen. And I think we're going to like deploy the rest of the fund in like 1 to 2 months, right? And so we were really, really aggressive about deploying. We bought, like, we became, you know, the largest holder of Pudgy Penguins, buying from cash to ETH to Pudgy Penguins on Blur. And that turned out to be like a really good trade, and that opened up a lot of like stuff for us. So that was kind of how we started, was like just kind of doing things like that. And it's definitely evolved a lot in the last like two years, basically, of like what Spencer Ventures is. But, you know, we're just kind of opportunistic on-chain fund. We started to do a couple of, like, in the last couple of months, we've started to do a few choice venture investments, but mostly we do on-chain weird stuff that I think is interesting.
That's awesome. Okay, so I love the idea of having a broad mandate, because in this market that is so immature, it's brand new, there's so many weird factors, so many weird things going on, you need to have a broad scope and you need to be nimble to take advantage of certain opportunities. So it's awesome that you even called the firm Spencer Ventures, as in like, this is kind of my thing. So that makes total sense to me. Yeah. What subsector of the NFT markets are you most excited about or like active in? Because, you know, we have gaming, we have collectibles, we have art, you know, there's the, you know, virtual land or whatever. Is there a sector that you prefer?
I think, to me, is it's not a sector I prefer. It's more of a mindset. It's like, I want to back a founder that has a take on the space. I don't even care that much that I agree with the take on the space. It's just like, I think people are like, oh, like, what's the next Bored Ape Yacht Club? No, like, Bored Ape Yacht Club did something that was interesting, right? But like, if everything is just trying to figure out how to do that again, like, we're going to go nowhere. And so my view is, we're like we're like maybe 4 years into NFTs as like an asset class. Like, we don't know what the best use case is. We don't know what the best thing will be. And there likely it will be multiple different things, right? It's not like, oh, NFTs will either be art or they'll be games. NFTs will either be, you know, collectibles or they'll be like, no, it clearly will be all of these things, right? And so what's most important to me is like, is a founder of project someone who like sees the chessboard, who like understands what's going on across the different protocols, across the different teams? And like, I think, you know, it's kind of, to me, it feels ridiculous, right? Like if you were to ask, you know, a venture investor, like, what is your favorite type of venture backed company? Like, I don't know, right? Like, they're all just different, like the financing mechanism is not what defines the company. The company is what defines the company, right? And I think that we will see that more and more in NFTs as projects split apart. I will say, like, for me, I think there's a couple of things that I think are inevitable that I don't think there's a good trade on. Like, I think NFTs in the context of like video game assets is obvious, is inevitable, is incredibly hard to find a good trade on. Why? Because despite its inevitability, de-risking which projects can actually make a game happen is so tough, right? And I think a lot of people misunderstand this concept of like, you can believe that something very specific is the future, but finding the best exposure to that thesis is really the question. It's not like, is this what's going to happen? It's like, will I be exposed to the right thing that happens here, right? And I think you see that actually play out in how capital flows, whereas like the art thesis, you know, it's really interesting to me that like in the art NFT space, which is something somewhere where I don't operate a lot. I almost never trade art. But one of the reasons is because like in art NFT space, almost everyone just buys art blocks. It's like Fidenza, it's Ringers, it's Autoglyphs. It's like 99% of the whole volume of the market is like three collections, right? And they're all same parent collection. So while that, and why is that? It's because it's the most obvious thing, right? And it's like, okay, how do I get exposure to NFT art? Like just buy a Fidenza. Right, like it's really just that simple, I think, for a lot of people. And so I'm sure that's like a buy a Fidenza, buy a Squiggle. Like I'm sure that can be a profitable thing, but it's not like super interesting to me because it feels kind of like a solved question. And I'm much more interested in like weird takes on the art space.
So again, I love that. It's the ability to just try to dig deep and identify where you can generate returns in unusual places. How are you ideating on these different trades, if you will, investments? Because, you know, like there's just such a deluge of like Twitter spaces, Twitter tweets, Medium blog posts, just like there's so much information. How are you able to, yeah, ideate on these different trades?
Yeah, I would say there's a couple of different like fundamentals that we follow when we're looking at stuff. So like one is, you know, I think, so the benefit of having a fund is like, we can take a long-term view on certain things, but like taking a long-term view means that like, if something goes from like 0.2 ETH to 0.4 ETH, it's not really like, that's not the run that I care about like at all, right? Like for it to move the needle on me, I would need to have like a couple hundred and then also be able to exit a couple hundred. But like, that's not a 2X. Like that's one of the big like realizations that I've had is like when you're running a fund, you're running like, you know, millions, tens of millions of dollars of capital, like going from 0.2 to 0.4 is not a 2X. And that's like a weird thing to sit with, right? And so for that reason, like for me, you know, I'll go talk to founders, try and diligence them, try and have like an interesting conversation. Like that's a big part of my process. You know, who are the new people in the space? I think once you've kind of gotten connected to some people, if someone's, you know, there's certain people who are like, hey, this person's smart. All right, this is interesting. I'll take a meeting, et cetera. I think it's also, you know, reading sentiment is important, right? So how do you see where the market participants are headed? Like right now it's obvious like people are paying attention to meme coins and that's kind of like on Solana. And that's like what's going on in the market right now. Do I think that that's a structural shift that lasts forever? No, it's just like, that's the meta today, right? And so now is a great time to be diligencing people building other stuff because they're less attentioned, right? I think now is a tough time to be investing in meme coins because there's so much attention. That's kind of a where you want to be in like a contrarian long-term view. Then like a second thing that I'll say too is like, I think there's a lot recently, there's been a lot of financialization protocols that have been launched in the NFT space. They're a little bit confusing to understand, right? And spending time really trying to understand those protocols is where a lot of our better trades have come from recently, because simply understanding the tool you're interacting with gives you an edge against like a larger percentage of the market than you would think. And once you have that level of understanding of multiple tools, you can see how they work across each other, right? But also like, this is one of the benefits for us. It's like, we get to do weird, cute trades that I think are interesting that may or may not be profitable. Like we've certainly spent times automating things we think are ARBs that end up making like fractional, like less than an ETH, which like clearly is not worth the dev time to do, but you never know when that exploration leads to something that is later useful, right? Like I think a lot of the things that I feel beneficial about getting to do is like, I can invest in tooling that we have on the shelf that isn't super profitable today, but I could see being used in a generalized sense later, or like even just like generalized set of tooling. Like when certain protocols come out, I just direct my devs to like make toolings that we can call functions to interact on the different fundamentals of this protocol such that like if we discover an ARB at any point, we can be first to market on closing that ARB, if that makes sense.
That's awesome. Okay, so I want to dig into so much, but I know we have to kind of have some sort of, you know, end to this, unless you have like 4 hours. But okay, so you're talking about these financialization protocols. Can you, without going to, you know, without revealing anything, can you kind of describe from a high level some detail on that, or would you prefer not to? Totally fine if you don't want to.
It's like there's a couple of protocols that are coming out or have come out that like do something that is more complicated. And I think, you know, this is a really interesting thing to watch, right? Is like, you know, one protocol that obviously I provide a lot of liquidity on, and I think is a really interesting one, is Wasabi. Wasabi was a covered options protocol. They had a really elegant product that did not a lot of volume. They then launched a covered perpetual swaps product that does a lot of volume, right? And this is very interesting because in traditional markets, options do way more volume than perps, way in like, you know, TradFi. Everybody loves options. Market making firms love options. You know, people are just, black shoals get solved all the time. People love pricing options, right? In coin market, everybody loves perps. There's almost no options volume. And this is like very interesting, right? And so, you know, I think you see the market shifting in different ways. Now you also have like the number of different perps products that we're getting access to in NFTs is really substantial. Like you have NFT perp.xyz, you have Wasabi perps, you have Tribe 3 coming out, you have like all sorts of different, I think there's Particle Trade on, actually, I don't know if that's even an NFT in specific, but like you have a bunch of like Blast perps that ostensibly will probably have, maybe even Blur comes out with its own perp. I don't know, right? But like you have a lot of perps products. And from a retail perspective, you might look at that and be like, oh, cool. Like these are all like, you know, perps. I want to go up, down, like whatever. But if you look at how these protocols work, they're like completely unrelated to each other almost. Like what they actually do and the risks associated and like the funding rates and how the funding rates move are just like totally wildly, like almost incomprehensibly different, right? Like at the most fundamental level. And I think, you know, if you look at like NFT perp versus Wasabi, this is like a great example of this where like to go, so like when you go long, so if you take a levered long position on Wasabi, right, it will take ETH from its liquidity pool. It will, so like let's say you go 4x levered long on one ETH. It'll take 5x levered long on one ETH. It'll take 4 ETH from liquidity pool and it'll go buy the token that you're longing, right, from the market. When you sell, when you close that position, it will take that and it will sell the token, right? And if it ever goes below the collateral, it will just liquidate, right? And so your liquidation threshold is the one ETH you put down is the what they're willing to lose because they don't have to pay it back to you, but they do have to pay back the liquidity pool, right? And so this is what a covered perp is. Now, the funding rate is slightly more expensive, but like I would say this is like a low protocol risk. Now, if you look at what like NFT perp does, right? NFT perp is a synthetic perp. So when you go long, it doesn't actually go buy the asset off the market. And when you go short, it doesn't like do anything either, right? And so it keeps its peg via a funding rate. Now, this usually offers you probably like better rates and probably better size, but also means that their insurance pool has risk, right? And we saw before their insurance pool. Look, now, these are just like very different things, right? No, it's not one is better than the other, but like understanding what that difference is really key to understanding what strategies you can run with each of them, right? And I'm a big believer of like, if you don't understand how a protocol works, don't use it. Like, in the space who use these types of products should spend more time understanding the fundamental way in which the thing that it purports to be doing is delivered, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I love that you are digging deep because it's so different than the current market environment, which, you know, I call like, you know, like what, time to ape. It's like,
yeah,
the time to ape into what you're talking about is very long because you need to study, you need to research, et cetera. You need to actually use the product and understand the intricacies. And then you have meme coins, which is just like, you know, buying Bonk or dog with hat or whatever. What is your thought process on the current market environment and how it's almost as if 2021 NFTs were the meme coins? It's like,
yeah,
Bored Apes is just like, you know, kind of a cool thing to have. It's kind of like a status symbol. Now we don't even, not even status is the appealing thing. It's like, I just want to make money. So I'm going to go with buy Bonk or Dogecoin or whatever. What is your thought process on the current meme coin environment?
I think I don't fully agree with your premise in the sense of like, I don't think it's just like, oh, like it's Bonk, whatever. Like we look at meme coins. We actually trade meme coins sometimes. We were Moggin for a bit. Like we've got some other meme coins. Like, like, I think for me, you've like, my understanding of the meme coin game is this, is like, it is a game of getting listed on a centralized exchange, right? Like, the thing that meme coins have going for it is like, you have two pools of liquidity. One is bigger, one is smaller. You have on-chain liquidity and you have exchange liquidity. And if you make it to the exchange, you almost always go up in price. Why? Because exchanges have more liquidity than markets. And actually, meme coins are very easy to list on exchanges. People always kind of misunderstand this thing. It's like a utility token that has like staking and accrues value is very hard to list on an exchange. Why? Because of regulatory concern, right? Exchanges don't like to delist their tokens. And if you get a regulatory action against your token, you know, we saw this, right? Like the Coinbase lawsuit named Polygon, named Solana. Like, these are risks that exchanges don't like to take. Now, obviously, I think, you know, those coins are like pretty fundamental to crypto and probably like won't, but like, there are issues if you're named in like SEC actions, right? And so, you know, we don't see meme coins named. Why not? Because they don't do anything. They're not purported to do anything. It's like very on the nose of like, this isn't meant to be a thing that does anything. This is just a meme. And that actually is the lowest on the scale of regulatory risk. And exchanges are all about regulatory risk. This is the thing that's going on there. So like, meme coins make a lot of sense from like, if you're trying to get a coin listed on an exchange perspective, right? And I think that that's the run, is like, you have a greater, like, everyone who sees it on chain knows there's this big pool of exit liquidity that isn't them that exists later. For NFTs, like, the challenge is that like, last cycle they were growing, and like, you know, Coinbase Marketplace was going to launch and like all this stuff, right? There was increasing pools of liquidity that you could see coming in every day. Right now, we don't have that in the same way. My argument would be, I think that like, the projects that are going to do the best are ones that actually find that same second pool of liquidity, which is like what ApeCoin did, MemeLand did. Most NFTs to me are like pre-airdrop tokens. Like, this is like basically the private markets of tokens, is like similar to how you might do a venture investment before you would get like public equity. You do you buy an NFT before you get token, right? And if that token is listed on a tier one exchange, is market made by a tier one market maker, like, that is a greater pool of liquidity than exists on chain for NFTs, especially now. And so like, that's the arb that you can run. It's like, where am I going to get a token that's going to be listed on a tier one exchange, basically?
That's awesome. Okay, so when you look at different investments, and I think your answer is probably going to be, it depends, but are you looking at assets that have some sort of event coming up that you're trying to, get into that position before that event? Or is it a narrative thing where, hey, you know, everyone's changing their PFPs to Bored Apes, therefore, you know, I want to acquire some? Like, what are the, or is it fundamentals based off of, you know, the demand of this NFT, like, we should acquire more because we can see the demand is going to continue to increase. What do you invest off of? Is it event-based, narratives, fundamentals, or is it kind of a mixture?
It's really tough at the size that we trade to be event-based. Like, I think if you're a smaller trader, like, it's great. And I kind of miss that time, but like we can't enter or exit positions quickly enough to really make meaningful returns on event-based trades. Like, for us, it kind of has to be a macro swing trade. Like, this is what we think thematically overall is going on. And like, this is where we think that like, we can back a team that builds real value over time versus like, yeah, we think this narrative will be hot at this moment. And like, you know, that's great. Like, that's not super, super interesting to us. Now, I think like, you know, the whims of narrative are pretty fickle, right? Now, that's not saying we ignore this, right? So one thing that like, I think I have two stances, I think have shifted a lot since even when I launched the firm, is like, you know, I used to be under the assumption of like, okay, like if you look at where Sandbox and Decentraland were last cycle, like Other Side, for example, has this great opportunity because like the virtual land narrative was like really strong last cycle. You saw a lot of real estate people coming in, and just made sense to them. You hear like nobody talking about the virtual land narrative now, right? Like, I think, you know, two things that were really strong last cycle that seem to be not at all strong this cycle is virtual metaverse land narrative. It just didn't play out and people lost so much money. I think it's just, I wouldn't be shocked if this is a dead narrative now. And DAOs. So many people were so obsessed with this concept of DAO. Like, everything was going to be a DAO, this DAO. And none of the DAOs worked, right? You see, this is like the biggest challenge for ApeCoin is that it's interesting. You look at MemeCoin versus ApeCoin, and MemeCoin doesn't do anything. And somehow this is better than ApeCoin, which is a DAO, because of the dysfunctions of the DAO. And like, I think that like one of the core challenges with DAOs to me is, I call this the Bodie McBoatface issue. Do you know about the USS Bodie McBoatface?
Yeah, like I think the Navy was like, hey, who wants to name to the internet? Who wants to name our boat?
Yeah. So it was like a US research vessel that they spent like $100 million on. and they put a poll on Reddit and we're like, whoever wins the poll is the name of the boat. And they named it the USS Bodie McBoatface. And my point here is, like, if you ask the internet to make a decision, don't be surprised if you get an internet style decision. Like, why does Nouns spend $150,000 sponsoring someone doing a backflip on a wheelchair? Like, is it the most beneficial thing for Nouns? No, it's the most funny thing that you could back as a community. Right. And I think, like, there's a place and time for DAOs like that. Like, I think that that's a very cool part of culture. I think Nouns is a cool thing, but, like, the idea that, like, every company is going to be a DAO is just fundamentally wrong. And I think we've realized that. We've seen so many of the challenges, so many of the struggles. Now, it's an interesting regulatory argument, maybe, right? Like, we see, even, like, you know, but, like, I don't see that narrative being as strong as it was last cycle, this cycle, because it just didn't play out. And it's not like there wasn't good, meaningful attempts for it to do so.
Okay, so can you talk about any of your, you've done some really, really cool things in the special situations kind of a category, we can call it. Can you talk about any of those in any sort of detail, or even, like, from a high level standpoint?
Yeah, so I think this is public. Is like we bought the Pudgy Penguins from the three Arrows Capital, like, default estate, which was a pretty cool, like, thing to have gotten to do. You know, obviously that you can kind of guess how well that's played out. It's been pretty great, but also it was, like, kind of an interesting thing for us to do. Of like, well, we kind of know that this block is gonna, like, they're auctioning off a bunch of the assets. Like, they haven't auctioned off the PFPs yet. They've auctioned off the art. You know, I think Pudgy Penguins are fine art, but separate discussion. But like we know this block is going to hit the market, right? Like, and I had gone around and tried to buy out most of the big Pudgy Penguin holders, and, like, nobody wanted to sell, right? Or the ones that did, I just bought out already on chain. But you know that there's this big, like, 0.5% of the supply, more than 0.5% of the supply block that, like, is just kind of like, who knows what's going to happen. If you ever go to the Pudgy Penguins collection and you look, the Sotheby's wallet is, like, the third, like, you know, third or fourth largest holder of this asset. And, like, I think that makes people uneasy. And so for me, I was like, okay, like, these NFTs have had this, like, turbulent time. Let's find them a good home. And, like, that was a cool thing to have been able to do. You know, another one too was like speaking of market makers, right? This is kind of an interesting special situations was, I don't know if you know the project Art Gobblers. When Art Gobblers launched, there was a market making Art Gobblers, but only on Blur. And you could tell that was kind of what was going on. And this was before Blur even had bids. So they were just like the bid was them buying off the floor. And they were, like, totally ignoring the price on OpenSea. So we were just market making OpenSea. Like, we were the bid on OpenSea. Every time we got filled, you would sell immediately on Blur, right? And it was like a 2 ETH spread for like 2 hours, which is like, I mean, that's crazy, right? Imagine telling someone in traditional markets that you had even like 0.02 of a cent spread for 2 hours is crazy, right? Like, we had a 2 ETH spread across marketplaces for 2 hours. That's bananas. That makes no sense, right? And, like, that's it, to give you a sense of how inefficient this market is like, yeah, that kind of stuff happens all the time. Another one too, this was, like, interesting, was like when Blend first launched, there was all these opportunities where you could borrow at like 0% APY. And, like, you know, the most vanilla one was borrow against your punk at 0% APY, convert your ETH to STEETH and earn 3% APY on STEETH. And, like, that existed for like months. And then, like, you know, I knew people who were doing it, like, borrow against it, go to Eigenlayer, like, restake your ETH, like, throw it into Aave. Like, there are all these, like, funny, I mean, there still is a lot of funny, like, interest rate arbitrages that exist on, like, Blend and some of the other, like, NFT lending things. It's just a very curious, like, thing that we have going on.
So how do you think about different NFTs on different chains? So you have Ethereum, Solana, now Ordinals, you have like Bitcoin. How do you view the underlying chain, or do you not really care?
No, I mean, I think it matters, right? Like, I think, I think taking a step back, right? Like, what you have to realize is NFTs are a great part of ecosystems. Like, one thing that happens in crypto is we want, everyone likes infrastructure, right? Everyone wants to back their L1, their L2, whatever, right? Their L3 even. But, like, the thing is that, like, everyone wants infrastructure. Everyone wants to trade infrastructure and infrastructure for trading infrastructure. But, like, you need stuff to, like, happen inside the infrastructure, right? And that can kind of be DeFi, but, like, really one of the more, like, large, if you look at the last cycle, drivers of the main thing that matters to an L1 or L2, which is transaction volume, is unique users, is TVL, is, like, gas fees generated, was NFTs. And so, like, a lot of these infrastructures and ecosystems that try and launch, it's really important, or they see it as important, at least, and I think they're right, to see it as important that they have an NFT ecosystem. Now, NFT ecosystems are actually very difficult to spin up, right? I was talking with a senior exec at one of the big like L2s, and they were like, look, like you want like DeFi, $100 million, you have DeFi, right? You just throw it at the problem and solve. Like you want culture, you want NFTs, like very difficult. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, right? And so I think you see this play out. Like I think Bitcoin Ordinals is obviously very interesting, right? It's great, strong narrative this cycle. I think Solana NFTs, we have a big position in one Solana NFT. It's great. You know, there's lower transaction fees. That's good and bad. Like I think friction is generally good. This is my contrarian take, is like high gas fees is good. It's what keeps prices higher. Like the behavior of Solana NFT traders is very different from Ethereum NFT traders. I think one ecosystem we're pretty bullish on is Say. Like I think that's a really interesting kind of just like, if you look at where Solana, like Solana was the chain for people that didn't have a lot of money, but like now it's very expensive. So I think like Say is like an interesting, like where do people go when they come into crypto if they want to like play around? Is like Say is a great playground sandbox for them to start in. But like in call a spade, most chains have struggled to make NFTs happen. And I think it's also a question of like, even like, you know, I do this full time. I have a team. We all do this full time. Like just staying on top of Ethereum NFTs is a full-time job for a full team, right? Like one of the big mistakes I see people making in crypto is trying to be an expert in a bunch of different things that are very like distinct, right? And so, you know, it's all like, trading crypto is an exercise in time allocation. And so if you're allocating time to six different chains at the same time, even as a team, but especially as an individual, like you're doing it wrong. You should be a domain expert in one area rather than know a little bit about a lot, is how I view this market. Is like what's tough about taking that approach is there are times when where there aren't good trades. Like one of the hardest things when you have that like focused contrarian approach is like we'll spend 3-4 months with making barely any trades, anything interesting, because like there isn't an obvious or interesting thing to do. But when that thing happens, like we know the most, we're the most ready, et cetera. Like that's worth it to me, because really in crypto, and I think again, this is where a lot of people get wrong, is like you don't need to be making money every single day. Some of the best crypto traders I know make one or two plays and they make money 3 days a year and it's 20% each time. And that's a ridiculous return, right? Like if it's 2x each time, you're gravy. Like you don't need more than 3 2x's a year. Like it's really that simple. And like, you know, if you get one, you know, we think of it as like if we get one 10x, 50x per fund, like that's a huge win of the entire fund, right? Now, like thankfully we've gotten a few more than that, but like if you're chasing, like if you hit every big win in the space, you're taking too many swings at bat, right? Like it's not about hitting every win, it's about not losing on most of your trades. That's, I think, a thing that people get wrong, because losing on a trade in crypto is going to zero. It's not like, oh, I lost 5% because I was wrong on my earnings call on some SPY asset. No, you went, you aped something that rugged and it went to actual zero.
All right. So how do you think about Grails versus floors?
So this is the thing that I'll carry over from my trading card days, is it is either the best or it is a floor, right? Like there's no in between of these two. And there's completely distinct markets, right? You see, like very interestingly, right? Recently, there was a Pudgy Penguin, ice skin Pudgy Penguin, that sold for 150 ETH when the floor was like 15 ETH. Now, if the floor was 22 ETH and there was a scale of an ice skin for 40 ETH, right? So these are like kind of uncorrelated markets, which is just like an interesting phenomena to observe. In that, Grails are great. They're way less liquid. I like them. But you need like the grailiest of grails. You can't have like, oh, this is, you know, it's clean. Like it's worth more than floor, bro. Like no. Most things are floors except for like true grails. And the true grail collectors are not the same people who would have otherwise bought the floor. Like there's very few people. I mean, I do this, but there's very few people who do the math. Like, okay, I could buy 20 floors or one grail. It's just like, I want the nicest thing. I have money, buy. Right. And I think that's where you see like some of the bigger influxes of capital come to grails. But you know, they're way harder to sell. There's way less of a market for them, et cetera. If that makes sense.
I prefer, personally, I prefer floors in the sense that, yeah, that there's greater liquidity. And yeah, I think that you can enter it. Basically, liquidity. That's basically what it boils down to. So I've personally stayed away from Grails. But when you do the math, is it random in terms of sometimes the grail math outperforms, sometimes the floor math outperforms, or in general, have you found that, oh, it's actually grail is generally outperform?
No, I think it's this. I think what it is like you have to in your head have a price where you'd buy any asset at, right? Like, you know, for me, so like I'll give a great example of this. So the goose, right? I think everyone knows the goose, right? I do not like ringers. Why? Because Dmitry Cherniak stole ringers from a guy named Nick Cutter. So there's actually a collection that minted on chain before ringers. Guess what it's called? Rings. Ringers? No, it's called rings.
Wow.
And this guy, Nick Cutter, posted on Instagram, like, here's the generating formula for it. And Dmitry Cherniak replied to the Instagram post, said, cool, let me play around with it, right? And ringers is generated a few days later. So like Dmitry Cherniak like took this formula from somebody else. Never hear anyone talk about that, right? And like Nick Cutter's rings piece was supposed to be auctioned in one of the first Sotheby's auctions and was suddenly pulled the last minute from the auction. You know, conspiracy theory, whatever, but like, I don't like ringers. Like, it's one of my least favorite things for this reason. However, I bid on the goose. Why? Because like there is a price where I would buy the goose. Now, was my price anywhere near what it sold for? No. And that was because I was right that someone would later pay more for it, right? Like, my price for the goose was around $1 million. Like, I probably would have bought it for that. But like, that's because that's a low ball offer. But like in life, you sometimes need to make those low ball offers because like why not, right? Like, you need to figure out what the like, and it's because of like this thing of like grails are less liquid. So when you can be liquidity in a less liquid market, you can get ridiculous discounts on like what true value is if you have the luxury of spending time to find the right buyer, right? Like, we've been able to do that various times of like, okay, like someone is panic selling their asset. Like, you generally, like, it's not a bad idea to buy panic sold assets, right? Whereas like, you know, I guess in other contexts, for example, you know, if I were just shopping, would I just go buy the floor of a grail? Like, usually not, unless it seemed mispriced. You know, I think I've gone on the record a lot of times of like when Pudgy Penguins were running, like we bought a lot of gold Pudgy Penguins. Why? Because like, you know, gold Pudgy Penguins trading at 2-3x floor was like ridiculous. Like, that doesn't make any sense. When they usually trade at like 10x floor. Now you've seen like, there's just a lot of people like, hey, they were up a bunch, they're looking to get out. Like, okay, we'll buy them out. But like, that's something that I think over time will be a really good play, right? Because it was mispriced because there wasn't liquidity at Grails at that time. And that's okay. Like, I can be that liquidity. So it's like, you know, that's how I think about it, is like, I only buy Grails when it's like too good a price to refuse. Otherwise I go for floors.
I love that. I had no idea about ringers. That's shocking. I need to, you know, I don't personally, you know, play too much in the art market. But it's something I should know. The current, I don't want to see the current meta, but points are very big. So that's kind of one aspect of this question. But then there's also the idea that some of these NFT collections will be airdrop tokens. So I guess those are kind of slightly separate, you know, kind of related in some sense, because you're at the end point, you're still getting tokens. What are your thoughts on this meta strategy, whatever, about points and or NFT collections for tokens?
My view of NFTs, I think NFTs are the private markets of crypto. Like, I think NFTs, like if you look at Bored Apes, right? Like, Bored Apes did a similar arc to what a venture-backed company did. Instead of doing so venture-backed company, pre-seed, seed, growth stage, IPO, right? Like, that's kind of how it goes. Bored Ape Yacht Club raised money via a mint for apes, raised money via a mint for mutants, raised money, so that was their pre-seed and their seed. Instead of a growth round, they did, they did a growth round, and they, you know, which was an investment from VCs with a token warrant. And then instead of IPOing, they launched a coin, right? This is actually incredibly healthy, right? So one of the things that I think has always been wrong about crypto space has been like, you have token launched with like a company that's like 3-4 weeks old or whatever, right? $500 million market cap. No 3-week old company is worth $500 million. I'm sorry, it just isn't, right? And it's impossible to grow into that valuation. So it wrecks your company to start off with too high a valuation, right? And so this is the problem of like only having one market. Now, traditional companies don't work that way, right? You have periods of time where you grow as a company and you can de-risk, and then you can move from a lower liquidity environment to a higher liquidity environment. And so I think this is like what NFTs should be, is like NFTs is a way to back a company early on. Now, if that company is successful, it will make it to the point where they launch the token on an exchange. And that's where like you get your access to bigger liquidity than what you had elsewhere. And so like, to me, like, as I said, like I like seeing people who see the chessboard. This is the chessboard, is like, how do you, as an NFT project, there isn't a larger, there is no like CEX equivalent that has more liquidity that's going to bring you, right? Yet that for NFTs themselves, you have to go to fungible token because it's the only thing that has a greater pool and is a significantly greater pool of liquidity than like your existing holder base, right? And so that's how you can give someone a line of sight to like other exit liquidity that isn't just like other people in the ecosystem.
Is there a company in the space that you think has done exceptionally well from a, you know, from whatever standpoint you want to view it? And then is there a company in the space that you think needs to improve their performance, we'll call it?
I'm a big fan of Pudgy Penguins. I think that they're like doing it a lot right. I think they're also just like positioned better than a lot of companies, right? Like, and obviously, like, you know, I'm bag biased here, right? I own a lot of Pudgy Penguins. I think that should be very clear from everything I've said, is like, but I own them because I believe this is like, they are just positioned super, super well in that, like, you know, they didn't have this 90% price decline in the last market under the same leadership they have today, which like most of the major collections do right now. I think, you know, one thing that I'm looking for, which has been surprising, is there hasn't been a major new NFT in a very long time, right? On the Ethereum blockchain, at least. Most people are launching on Bitcoin, but I think that like there will be new NFTs. You look at like the major recent NFT has been, I think, Mochaverse, right? You may even say Memeland is like a new NFT. And these have both been huge wins. It's like, and they're both companies related to tokens. They're both companies like coming out of Asia related to tokens. That's an interesting thing too, is like, you see the people who are able to access this token narrative much stronger coming out of Asia than the US right now, whereas the prior cycle was dominated by US-based companies. So I think that's a really, really big shift that people don't talk enough about. It pertains to companies that I think could do better. Like, I think, you know, look, the list of NFT projects shitting the bed is long. And so I'm not going to go drag through the mud any of those people. I think, like, that's not a productive part of this conversation. But, like, what I would like to see is companies that are struggling, I think they should try and throw a Hail Mary pass, like do something controversial or different that could blow up the company. And like, not enough, like people are too risk adverse. Is like, at this point, you've been around for 2-3 years, it's not working. Like, try something. Like, what is your risk? It goes to zero. You're already at zero. Like, you know, like whatever. Just like, there are things that I don't care. Like, if you have something that you think is a 10% chance to work, but it's this big outcome and 90% chance you send us to zero, like send us to zero with haste. Like, I want you to make that decision. And I think enough of these companies like aren't doing that, where they're like it's too risky or controversial. No, like be risky, be controversial. That's how you like do something different. Like, don't try and copy other people's playbooks, make a new playbook. And like, people aren't going to like it, right? That's fine. Some people are going to hate it. Some people might like it, but like, that's what we need, is more people taking more risks. We need new projects. You know, I think it's an interesting.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about PFPs and collectibles and some art. You mentioned before your thoughts on Web3 gaming, but can we dig again into Web3 gaming? You know, you said that NFTs within gaming is inevitable, but what about the actual NFT assets? Do you explore that world at all?
Yeah. So here's the thing for me, is like, I'm not convinced that like in-game assets being like tradable financial assets that appreciate in value is good for a game economy. And I think we see this with like Axie, where like Axie was a pretty good game, but like got wrecked by the fact that it became like a farm, you know, for points. So here, you want to hear a spicy take? So this is a spicy take I have. The number one best game that's been released in Web3 by a huge amount in the last 2-3 years is Blur's bid farming points strategy.
That's good. That's good.
This game is incredible. Like, if you look at the most fascinating thing I've ever like studied in depth, has been what the PvP relationship of the major bid farmers on Blur is. You don't see people talk about this at all, but it's incredibly fascinating how this works. Like, this is the most interesting financial like game theory game that I've ever seen play out, is like the major bid farmers on Blur and like how they interact with each other. Like, this is the best game. It has every component of a game. You know, there's money on the line, right? Like, it's in the sense of like, there's like, you know, lots and lots of money going around. So this is kind of like poker, right? There's theory being played out. There's strategies. There's like different levels of playership. Like, there's people who are playing, you know, small leagues, big leagues. There's direct PvP relationships. There's more generalist. It's just one of the most interesting things I've ever seen play out. Like, this is a good game. And I think people way over index on thinking about what a game is in a very closed-minded sense. In the sense of like, yeah, a game could be a bunch of people running around a 3D environment with guns, like building castles or whatever and shooting each other. But that's like a very naive view of what a game is, right? Really, the game is we all sit down on a computer and like press buttons all day and we get up and we leave. And like, you know, another good game is like DYDX, right? Like you see like a YOLO Games launch recently on Blast. Like one of their games is like predict if the price of Bitcoin will go up or down. Like that's a game, right? Like leverage trading is a game. Like all of this is a game to some degree. Like we're trading like coins with almost no fundamentals. This is a game, like understanding how the market is structured. And so like people's like Ohm was a good game, right? Like the, these are game, like I think people way over index on like, oh, like, you know, Dota is a game, like Overwatch is a game. Yeah, those are games. But like, you know, if you talk to like one of the best quants I know in the traditional world goes home after every day in his job and just plays RuneScape. And like, he's like, yeah, like, you know, he's like, I'm a great quant because it's just a RuneScape LARP. Like I am live action role playing RuneScape by quant trading. Like, and he trades with like hundreds of millions of dollars, like programmatically at like one of the biggest like quant hedge funds. And he's one of their best quants, if not their best quant. And his view is quant trading is a RuneScape LARP, right? Like that is how you have to think about this market, is like what a game is something that's like fascinating, engaging, and like has unique strategies by multiple players that evolve over time, right? And like Blur bid farming is the epitome of a game to me.
That's so cool. That's awesome. All right, Spencer, before going into the closing questions, is there any sort of topic within the NFT market sector, whatever, that we that you want to touch upon that we didn't talk about yet?
No, I mean, I can talk about this topic kind of ad nauseum, right? Like this is all I look at or care about. But I think, like, you know, I think we've covered a lot of different things. I think I'm just excited for watching this continue to evolve. Like there's just kind of never a dull moment, right? And that's always a cool thing. And I think, you know, one of the bringing it full circle a little bit, like one of the reasons that, you know, I made my fund Spencer Ventures. It's very clear to all my LPs that this is just like whatever Spencer wants to do is like what this fund does, is because like what the meta of interesting stuff is, I think as we've seen with the many different topics throughout this conversation, changes day to day, even like within just Ethereum NFTs, like, and it not only changes day to day, but hugely, if you look back 2 years ago, like the market worked just fundamentally different than it does today. And so I think like when you're entering the space, like people are like, oh, like, you know, are you an expert in NFTs? No, nobody's an expert in NFTs. This is a 3-year-old industry. Like anyone who tells you they're an expert in NFTs is lying through their teeth, right? Like, you know, how do you structure an NFT fund? I don't know. Like, what do I, let me go ask all the other NFT funds from 20 years ago how they structured. Like, you know, I think people don't embrace that enough. If, like, that's where we are in this market is like, I don't know. Like, I would say I probably know more than most, but I don't know. I don't have answers for you. If I had answers, like, I don't know. Like, we're just not at that point of this yet. And like, that's what's exciting about it, is we're not at that point of this yet, right? And so that's where we're trying to go.
Yeah, no, it's so funny you mentioned, you know, kind of being expert. So when I first got involved in NFTs in 2019, I was like, I don't know anything, right? And I learned a bit. And then I'd say 2020, I was like, oh, okay, I know a lot. Like, I'm pretty good at this stuff. You know, there was like four collections, right? Like I was like, I know a lot. And then now, like every week, I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Like there's so many things going on. There's so many different parts of the market. There's so many moving pieces. It's just, as you mentioned, you kind of have to choose your lanes, pick your areas, and really triple down in there in order to have any semblance of knowing like what's going on. So no, it's a really cool point you brought up there. But
yeah.
Awesome. All right, Spencer, time for the closing questions. First one, what are you bearish on?
So tough. I'm bullish on so many things. I'm bearish on founders that are not transparent with their communities about what's going on.
I would like to spice this up and ask, do you have any examples? But I'm not going to. But could you double click there in terms of, you know, is it just a runway thing? Is it like a, hey, we're not pursuing this game anymore we said we were going to do? Or you know, what do you mean by that?
I think that there's been a number of examples where like, people in the know, or like a large group of people in the know that something strange has happened, right? There was a weird fundraising round or like a co-founder departure, and like it's not publicly stated. And so people don't want to say it because they don't want to be the one to say it, especially because it's hard to substantiate, right? But like if you're in the know, you kind of know what happened. And so to me, it's like as soon as I hear it from like 3 or 4 other people, it's like, okay, this is a known thing, but people need to know, right? And so like, if you're a founder and you're waiting 3-4 months to tell people something that like everybody already knows, like you've done your community a huge disservice to like the people around them. So that to me is a very bearish thing, is like, even if you didn't want to say it, as soon as you know that like a quorum of people know it, like you kind of have to say it.
Totally. Okay. That makes sense. All right. Opposite side. What are you bullish on? You have to choose one thing.
My bags.
Of course. I mean, how can you not?
So like, no, I'm bullish on like, I'm bullish on this cycle for NFTs. I think we see much better builders come in than last cycle.
The activity has been so different comparatively. Is your thought process that this cycle is going to just bring in, just because there's not that like free money, you think it's going to bring in more quote unquote like serious founders that are dedicated to building something large or more impactful?
I think that a lot of serious founders I knew in the last, like sat out the last cycle to just watch it play out. I think we saw this with like early YouTube, right? In early first wave of early YouTube, random fucking people. And second wave of YouTube, almost all of those people were totally irrelevant because professionals from the media industry like came in and did professional content. And I think we saw that here too, where like last cycle in NFTs, people were big because they were right place, right time, and just like went for it, which is something that you should immensely respect, but not because they were good at the thing they were doing. I think the bar is much higher now because people who waited, the more savvy people that had a larger opportunity cost waited. And those people are coming in. Like, I think you see Luca as an example of someone who kind of did this, right? Like he bought a project after the first cycle was kind of winding down because he was an active market participant and he waited. And I think that's actually a huge thing too, is like almost none of the project founders. So if you last cycle, the beginning of last cycle, you chose, you could be a trader or a founder. If you chose founder, you've never traded this market. And so many of these founders were never participants in the market they're operating in, which is crazy. Like that shouldn't be the case. So I think people who are trading the last market to become founders should outperform those people.
All right. You have to choose one NFT that you pass on your kids. What is it?
Pudgy Penguin.
Really? Okay. Yeah. A specific pudgy or just any sort of pudgy?
I mean, clearly a grail, right? You know?
I love it. Awesome. All right. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I took a course when I was at Chicago, at UChicago booth by a professor, Michael Alter. And he's he was a clinical professor of entrepreneurship at the business school. And he founded and sold a company called Sure Payroll. Almost a unicorn exit. He always likes to say it's not. It was like $800 million. But again, we've had 12% inflation. So inflation adjusted, this is a unicorn. And he had this incredible class called Entrepreneurial Selling. And it was like one of the best classes I ever took. Definitely the best class I ever took. And like he went through a lot of things. And on one of the last days of class, he said, everybody sit down. He said, on one side of the piece of paper, I want you to write the perfect day. What's your perfect day? Write out every moment of what happens. Say, okay, now take another piece of paper, fold it in half. On one side, write down who you would call if the best thing ever happened to you. All the names, just like who would you call, right? On the other side, write down who you would call if the worst thing ever happened to you. All the names, right? And then back, he makes 2 points. He says, look at this list of the names. Anyone who's on both sides, that's the people who matter. That's the only people, like everyone else is like, you know, the people who really matter are the people on both sides of this list in your life. That's the thing. Okay. Look at this list of the perfect day for you. Was today that day? If not, why? Can you make every day that day? If so, how? And this is all that matters, is these two things. He's like, everything else will seem like it matters, but these two things are the things that actually matter. And I think, especially in crypto, I see a lot of people who get lost in the like grind of it and like forget why they're grinding. And I think like that's something that's very important to me, is always remembering like what is important on those two lists. Like, what am I working towards? And I think like that to me is very, very key. And like, I try and think about that as much as I can. I don't know that I do the best job, totally transparent, right? I don't know that I do the best job of living up to that concept, but I think that that is a really core thing that people don't stop to evaluate enough because it's uncomfortable. And I think it's uncomfortable to think about what's important to you in life, but because it's uncomfortable, and you can just live life without ever thinking about it, right? Do it. That's by far the easier choice. But like, this is a hard choice I think is important to make, is to step frequently and evaluate who is important to you. What is important to you? What do you want out of, like, you know, you only have so many days on this earth, right? Like, what do you want out of them? And so I think, you know, the most important advice to me has nothing to do with trading. It has to do with life.
That's amazing. Wow. That's so incredible. After this pod, I need to go do that exact exercise.
Yeah, do it.
That's,
no, I'm for sure. Freaking do this exercise. Amazing.
I love that.
I've kind of spoiled it for you a little bit, but.
No. I'm excited to see like what I put down because I don't know. You know, I want to see what the actual results are. All right.
Right. But isn't that crazy? It's crazy to think that you don't know. Like you don't. Totally. It's not an obvious thing. Yeah. No, right?
Like as you're saying, I'm like, okay, you know, this person, and you know, this would be something that I'd want to do every day, but. I'm like, I don't fully know yet. So no, it's going to be a fun exercise. This kind of relates to, this is the last question, kind of relates a little bit. What motivates you?
So, okay. I will say I have a kind of strange take on life, right? Like for me, like I think if you think really hard about the meaning of life, like there clearly is none. Like this is how I believe, right? And I think there, you have two options when you come to this conclusion. And I'm not saying this is a conclusion other people should reach. This is just a conclusion I've reached. As a matter of fact, I'm very happy for people who have reached any other conclusion than that. But I've thought very long and hard about this question, and that is, I think, my only rational conclusion. Now, you have two options when you reach this conclusion. One, both the reasonable, rational conclusions. One is, this is deeply upsetting, right? It's very easy to reach this conclusion and become a nihilist, right? Very rational to reach this conclusion and become a nihilist. Or, two, the harder choice, I think, is you can choose to believe that this is very funny, right? This is endlessly funny, in which case you become an absurdist. So I choose to be an absurdist. This is why I, in my job, trade pictures of animals on the internet for a living. Why? Because I think this is funny. And I look at all of my friends who are in the quant hedge fund world, and I think that I'm contributing equally to society, if not more than they are, which is not at all, right? And so like I view myself as an unproductive in society. And I think that it's fun to be an unproductive and it's funny, right? To me, like finding the funny and joy in moments is important, but like, you know, building that worldview of things is like, you know, what do you optimize for? You optimize for the funny outcome, the interesting outcome, if that's your worldview. Now, other people have other things. I know a lot of people answer this question with religion or some of these other kind of concepts, and I think there's a lot of fair answers. But that, to me, if you wonder like how do you end up doing what you're doing, is like I think everything's funny, right? Like this is like a ridiculous thing that I'm doing in a ridiculous like industry that exists in a ridiculous world that we live in. And I think, you know, a lot of things in life just kind of happen, right? We see a very complicated world we're in now, and there's many, and I think very many rational views of everything going on in the world is incredibly upsetting. And you can be kind of constantly stuck in the upsettingness of it, especially in a world of social media, but like you need to find your own brevity, right? And you know, to me too, like I think of, you know, a really impactful moment for me, you know, like I lived in New York during like 9/11, during Twin Towers, all that stuff. And like the pivotal moment I feel in that whole arc for our society, because it changed a lot of things, right? If we're like, imagine our society is an anime for a moment. Like, what's the pivotal arc? Is like on SNL that weekend. I don't know if you remember this clip, but this is like one of the most impactful things to me, but they just didn't know what to do, right? Like, they brought firefighters that were at the Twin Towers onto SNL. And the host of SNL asked, you know, is it okay? Can we be funny? The firefighter looked at him with a deadpan and said, there's never been a better time to start. And that was the moment, at least as a New Yorker, that I knew it was going to be okay. Right. And like that to me is find those moments in life. When is it clear it's going to be okay? Because brevity lightens the situation, because there's nothing funny about that, but you have to choose to find the joy and excitement in every moment, regardless of how intense it is, right?
That is the most beautiful answer I've ever heard, ever. That is incredible. And I love the way that you, your take on life is very refreshing and funny and silly, and it makes total sense to me. So I love that. Thank you for that. Spencer, this was amazing. Yeah, thank you again for taking so much time to talk about all of this. If people want to find out more about yourself or Spencer Ventures, where should they go?
Well, thank you for having me on, Andrew. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, so you can, you know, follow me on Twitter, SGSand1. I also have at Spencer. And then also, like, if you want to go to our website, it's just spencer.vc. So super Spencer, like VC, like Victor Charlie, super simple. You can always reach out to us. My DMs on Twitter are open. You know, we're always looking for interesting people and, growing the tribe. So, you know, follow us, be our exit liquidity, you know, buy our bags, like all those sorts of things. And, you know, just find some joy in the world.
Love it. Thank you, man.
Thank you so much for having me.